We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus on WILL AM 580 Illinois Public Media. This is Carol Spindell sitting in for David Inge, and in the 10 o'clock hour, we will be speaking with social psychologist James Pennebaker, the author of a new book called The Secret Life of Pronouns, What Our Words Say About Us, published by Bloomsbury Press. James Pennebaker is Regent Centennial Professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and he has devoted his professional life to examining the way we use both written and spoken language. In this book, he shows how words we might consider insignificant, such as pronouns, articles, and prepositions, can reveal our inner feelings. After feeding thousands of texts into computers, from Craigslist ads to presidential news conferences to Beatles lyrics and everything in between, and analyzing the results, he and his students and colleagues have found patterns both distinctive and revealing. If you'd like to join our conversation with a comment or a question for our guest, call us at 217-333-9455, or from farther away, you can use our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We'd love to hear from you. James Pennebaker, welcome to Focus.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
We're delighted to have you. This is a fun topic. The first thing you tell us in this book about word analysis is that we need to separate content from style, and that once we've done that, we can see that some words provide meaning and content, and other smaller words serve supporting functions. So explain a little bit before we sort of shoo them off the stage here about content words.
Well, content words are the words that we use to convey basic content. So they're usually nouns and regular verbs, some adjectives and adverbs. These are the content-heavy words. If I'm talking to you about going to the store this afternoon, going, store, afternoon are all examples of content. And all those other words, I am, to, the, this, are what we sometimes call style words, or linguists often refer to them as function words.
Now, those little words that you pointed out in that sentence almost disappear. I mean, we hardly notice them.
That's what's so amazing about them. We never pay attention to them. When we're reading, we almost jump over them. But they're remarkable because they are almost invisible, and there are not that many of them. So in English, there are a total of maybe 500, only 150 of which are common. And they make up about 50 to 60% of all the words we say, all the words we hear. And it's kind of ironic. It means you can learn another language, half of another language in an afternoon. You don't need to know that many words to know these.
Uh-huh.
So for example, let's say you want to learn Finnish. What you can do is spend an afternoon, learn the 100 most common function words, and then you'll be able to pick up a paper or a philosophy book and read and understand every other word in the book and have absolutely no idea what the authors are talking about.
Well, I don't think I'll test that out. But so you and your colleagues decided to develop a computer program to analyze these words that most of us just ignore when we speak or write. So tell us a little bit about that, how you decided to develop the program and how it works.
Well, much of my career, I focused on how people cope with the upheavals and traumas in their lives. And in the 1980s, I discovered a way to improve people's physical health and mental health by having them write about traumatic experiences for 3 or 4 days, maybe 15 minutes a day. And what we found was this method was really powerful in influencing people's health. They went to the doctor less. There were biological changes. And as after that first study, we and other labs started to do more and more. We all started trying to figure out, what is it about writing that makes a difference? And I became interested in analyzing the actual writing itself. And we found that it was just too complex for humans to do, and I figured a computer program might be a little faster and more efficient. And I couldn't find one that would work, and so with the help of one of my graduate students, we wrote a computer program. And the computer program is called Linguistic Inquiring Word Count, or LIWC, which we pronounce Luke, and I know it doesn't look like Luke, but whatever. In any case, the program was designed so it would go into any given text and simply calculate the percentage of words that were pronouns, prepositions, but also words like positive emotion words, negative emotion words, such as anger words, and sadness words, and cognitive words, and so forth. And such a program took quite a while to perfect, because we had to have a large group of judges agreeing on what words go into what category.
That sounds complicated, and therein lies the rub, I suppose. If these judges got it right, then the computer program functions well.
That's right. And for a lot of dimensions, there's a lot of judgment. You know, is annoyed an anger word, for example, and I think we probably did put it in the anger category.
Uh-huh.
But fortunately, things like pronouns are pretty straightforward. So everyone agrees that that I, me, and my are all first person singular personal pronouns.
Well, I believe you said that I is the most widely used word in English. Is that correct?
It is, in terms of spoken language and informal language.
Uh-huh.
If we look at textbooks or dictionaries or things like that, the word the comes up. But in everyday conversation, I is the winner.
One thing right away that's fun to look at is gender. Do women and men use these style words differently? And do women and men use the pronoun I differently? What did you find there?
This was a surprising thing for me. I had developed this program and was actually analyzing these essays that we were studying. And I kept looking at other things, and I've noticed there were big differences between men and women. But every time I looked at a study I had done, the results came out backwards. And what I did is what most researchers do, is I just ignored it because it didn't fit. So there must be something the matter, and the next study will come out right. And it never did. And one day I lined up all my studies and saw these huge and consistent differences between men and women. And they went just the opposite of what I thought, and it turns out what most people thought. So, for example, the differences between men and women in use of I, it turns out women use the word I at much higher rates than men do. And this is true not just in English, but in other languages as well.
Well, many people seem to think that the use of I is associated with assertiveness.
Exactly.
And in fact, recently Obama has been criticized by people who said, oh, he says I all the time. He's just, you know, too caught up with himself.
That's right. And it turns out that the word I is really more a marker of being self-reflective, being attentive to your emotions and thoughts and feelings. And so all of a sudden it starts to make a little bit more sense that women use I more. And in fact, someone who is more psychologically distant, who's not paying too much attention to themselves, does not use I much. And Obama's a great case in point, which is if you analyze his language in, say, press conferences, for example, where he's speaking more off the cuff, he uses I at rates lower than any other modern American president. And we have press conferences going back to FDR in the 30s. Obama's is very interesting the way that he uses language in general. He's very psychologically distant. He uses I at low rates. He uses emotion words at low rates. He's very cool in the way that he talks.
Yeah, I've read his memoir, and I was struck by the way he thinks. When I read his first memoir, and discussed it with people, it's he sort of goes all the way around a situation, discusses it from all viewpoints, and really gives everyone in the situation the benefit of the doubt in that memoir when he looks back at things in his life. And I think that's really quite unusual as a viewpoint.
You know, you're picking up on another feature of his language that fascinated me early on. We did these analyses of him versus McCain during the presidential election and also in the primaries. And Obama was just, he talks so differently. And one of the most striking differences is uses of nouns and verbs. And if you ask, if you look at someone like McCain or actually George Bush or Clinton or others, what they do is they use nouns at very high rates. And mm-hmm. Obama uses nouns at very low rates. He uses verbs at high rate. And so, for example, if both McCain and Obama were asked about the economy, McCain would basically say, well, there are three components to the economy. There's this and this and this, and under this second one, there's this and this. In other words, he's spending a lot of time categorizing and putting things in some kind of hierarchy, which is characteristic of Western thought.
Mm-hmm.
Obama, and after I tell you this, you'll never listen to Obama again in the same way. Obama puts everything in context, and usually historical context. So when he's asked about the economy, he doesn't say, well, there's this, this, and this feature of it. He says, well, you have to go back to the New Deal. And that led to this, which then led to this. And he puts everything in terms of how things have evolved over time, and which is a very different way of thinking, a very different way of laying out a story compared to most American politicians.
It's interesting. Maybe that's why he's having problems. He's a historical thinker in an ahistorical country.
That's an interesting way to put it.
Well, he also, maybe I'm wrong about this. I wanted to ask you. I have the perception that he uses we a lot, but maybe I'm wrong. You know, other people thought he used I a lot, and then you did the counting, and he didn't. So
he's not,
he use we or not?
No, he doesn't.
Okay.
That also makes him odd. We is also a very interesting word within the political landscape. Politicians often use we to try to pretend that they are more connected with the audience. But the audience usually picks up that that's not the case. In fact, one of my very favorite stories with this was the Bush-Kerry election in 2004. Here, it was a very close race. But the big problem that Kerry had was he was viewed as very cool and standoffish and stiff and actually cold. And in the way that he spoke, he used we all the time. He used the word I at very low rates. And I read in the New York Times that his press people or his handlers were now telling him to start using we more because they wanted him to come across as more warm and fuzzy. And I read that, and I thought, man, this guy's dead.
Why not? It sounds like good advice.
It sounds like great advice.
Let's go forward together.
Exactly. But the big problem is it's statistically associated with a distancing. It's kind of like my talking to my son, saying, we need to take out the trash. Or the waiter who says, what will we eat tonight? That kind of language really puts us off. It sometimes means you, or very often you don't even know who the we means. It just kind of means, I don't want to commit myself. And if you look, Bush at the same time was using I at twice the rate and we at half the rate as Kerry.
Uh-huh. But we is complex because we can sometimes mean we, the members of this group.
Exactly. And that's what makes it such an interesting word for me, is that there's about five or six different types of we, but there's the you and me together, we are going through this. And if the audience, if the people in the audience can specify and say, oh, that person is referring to this particular group, then it will work. But if you start listening to how often a speaker uses we, and you sit back and think, who is in that we? And if you can't answer that question easily, then it's probably not a warm, fuzzy we.
Interesting. Well, you also talk about the way we refer to perhaps our workplaces or things like that. Some people would say my office, my colleagues. Some people would say we're going to do this year. That would show a high rate of, you'd say that would show a workplace that functions well.
Right.
But if they say they, that's a bad sign.
Exactly. So here's a good test. If you want to get a sense of a work environment, sit down and talk to people and say, tell me about your work environment. And if they say, well, there's these people and they do that, that's a very bad sign. That means that person is not psychologically connected to the workplace at all.
Well, I was thinking as I was reading your discussion of politicians talking that we have that problem in the country right now because everyone speaks of they, the government.
That's right. They do.
We feel very divorced from it.
That is so true.
Okay, well, we have a caller on line one from Champaign County, so I'd like to invite that person to join the conversation. Hello.
Hi. Might one ask a question about comparative
grammar? One may.
Okay, well, I just use the subjunctive and one, both of which are not so used in English, and I just think that if one would use one more often, it wouldn't sound so foppish, and it would actually help lubricate some conversations. I'm sure most people have gotten into a place where they've had a conversation and they say, you might do this, or you are inclined to do what I'm trying to get at is that you can sometimes seem accusatory. Now, I don't know if this is, you're doing statistical analysis of public figures and public discourse, so I don't know whether you're looking into this comparative idea of sort of the psychology in languages. It just seems to me that, you know, you sound funny if you say one might do something. But it actually is a milder way to approach things. Is there anything you can say about that? I've always wanted to ask a grammarian or somebody about it. I guess I should have waited for the humorist that's on monthly or so, the English prof. But or maybe I've done it before, but what do you think?
Well, one of the interesting problems is the one approach is it's not very specific, and one loses sight of who the one is being referring to. Are we referring to myself or to you or that other person? So, but
that's the idea, I think, isn't it?
No,
it makes a general kind of.
It does, but we. One of the purposes of speech often is trying to be a little bit more specific. One of the interesting things about English, and actually all language that I know about, is how much work we put into being polite, so that we avoid being too accusatory. And you correctly point out the word "you" is one that can be a really harsh. It's almost a finger pointing kind of word. And I've always been intrigued how you can sometimes bypass that with the example you used. You might consider taking out the trash as opposed to take out the trash. And so we're able to soften this in this kind of subjunctive way of you might consider possibly.
But it's not really true. You're not. You really shouldn't consider it. You should do it.
That's exactly right.
Because your son could say to you, well, I've considered it, and I think I'll wait till tomorrow.
Exactly. No, and there's another thing that I also find very interesting is the use of hedging. So the difference between, and I think there's a sex difference here as well. So, for example, if you ask me what the weather is outside, I can say, well, I think it's warm, or I think it's hot, or I can say it's hot. And that saying, I think it's hot, is also really saying there are multiple perspectives here, and I don't want to go out on a limb. Some people might think it's cool, but I don't want to say too harshly, but I think it's possibly hot. And that just saying I think or I believe. And it's also interesting that public figures do this as well. Some do and some don't. Obama doesn't do it at all. He rarely says, I think or I believe. His is, this is truth or that is truth.
But in general, do men and women use hedge phrases differently?
They use them the same that I've noted. It's just it's that women just use them at higher rates.
Okay. And is there any difference in one? One is something people are taught to use in high school, is it not? I don't know if our caller is still there. Are you still there? I guess he hung up. Okay. Well, thanks for calling in. But one, what does that make a difference that people are trained to use a part of language rather than just picking it up naturally?
I would think so. To be honest, I haven't done much analysis of one, and there's a computer problem there because it's confused with the number one.
Oh. Okay. Won't work in the system.
Exactly.
Well, I was wondering about younger people. Do they use hedge phrases more because maybe they're more... I mean, it implies a certain tentativeness, doesn't it?
It does. And in fact, I love listening to teenagers because today's teenagers are the same as when we were teenagers and when my grandparents were teenagers. And that is they use words, the current use the word like a lot. So
yeah.
Like I went to the store... and like I bought so-and-so. And what that's really saying is I didn't actually go to the store. I did something kind of like going to the store. And or also using you know, so I went to the store, and then you know I bought so-and-so. And the person there is also almost asking, not permission, but, you know, this desperate need to connect with the other person, not to offend the other person. And so that hedging is a really... You know, during a period when people are really insecure, they are markers of trying to connect with others.
Now, if they take a good writing class, all that will be, they'll be taught to eliminate all that in their written communication.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So hopefully they'll be trained out of that.
But fortunately, Twitter will keep things connected.
Uh-huh. And that's another thing you point out in the book, that, of course, language changes with the situation in which we're using it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So one thing I'm interested in is kind of personality and language. So someone who is insecure, for example, will use the word I more. But we use I more depending on the context. So we all use I more in informal interactions as opposed to more formal ones. And we use them more when we are... kind of low down in the social hierarchy than when we are higher up in the social hierarchy, and we will change. So, for example, if I'm talking to a young student, I won't use I much, and if I start talking to a very senior, well-known professor, I will start using I a lot. And it's not anything that I'm doing consciously. It's not an issue of rudeness. It's just these are the social conventions that we have.
We have, yeah. Someone is subordinate to someone else, and I is one of the ways that they signal that. I was struck, having just read your book, when I opened my email this morning. And in it, I had an email from the CEO of Netflix. "Dear Carol," he said, and his first line really caught my attention. "I messed up. I owe you an explanation."
That is a brilliant PR person who wrote that.
I had to laugh. I thought, oh, I never met this guy, but he's certainly groveling here in my email.
Yeah, no, he's good. That's very good.
And I don't think there is another I in the rest of the email. No, at the very end, the very last paragraph, he goes back to I want to acknowledge and thank you and to apologize again. But those were the only I's in the very long, quite long email.
Okay.
So that was, and I also was struck, having just read the book this morning in the New York Times, there was an analysis published of Dominique Strauss-Kahn's interview on French TV yet last night.
Oh, I haven't seen that. I would love to see that.
Well, of course, it's in translation. I haven't seen the French, so I don't know how much that affects. But he did. I noticed some of those I statements really stood out. I wanted to be a candidate. I thought I could be useful. And having read your book, I thought, oh, these are very truthful statements.
Mm-hmm.
Because you talk about truth being associated with I.
That's right. We've done a lot of research, as have other labs now, trying to see if you can use language as a lie detector. And the reality is we do pretty well. We're not perfect by any means, but we've done studies where we had people come in and write about write essays that they truly believe versus those they didn't. We've had people participate in mock crimes where we induce them to steal a dollar and then we interrogate them. And also we've analyzed court transcripts of people who were found guilty and then found guilty again of perjury versus those who were found guilty and then were exonerated with DNA. And in all these cases, people who are telling the truth use I at higher rates than people who are lying. And they also use a group of words that are conjunctions and other function words that we call exclusive words. And these are words like except, but, without, exclude. These are words where a person is trying to make a distinction between what is in a category and what's not in a category. So if I'm telling the truth and I am trying to explain to my wife what I did last night, I'll say, well, I was going to come home at 10, but I got waylaid and I ended up going to the store, and instead of getting the pasta, I got the so-and-so. And so what I'm doing is I'm saying what I did do and also what I didn't do and what I thought about.
Kind of what you intended, but...
Right.
Right. Well, this is a fascinating subject. If we could just, you know, run everybody through your computer and know who's telling the truth in court and in government, and this would just make our lives so much simpler. I think this is a fantasy that we all have, that someone will come up with the perfect computer program. And so, but before we talk a little bit more about truth and deception, I want to again tell people this is Carol Spindell. You're listening to the first hour of Focus. And if you'd like to join our conversation with a comment or a question, please do. Please call us at 217-333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we're going to take just a brief break, and then we'll be right back with our guest, James Pennebaker.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com.
Welcome back to Focus. This is Carol Spindell again, and we're speaking with James Pennebaker, the author of The Secret Life of Pronouns, What Our Words Say About Us, published by Bloomsbury Press. So we were talking about how to tell when someone's telling the truth and when they're deceiving us. You looked at court cases, right? That was one
right.
way you knew.
Right. This is a project that we were able to get about 40 transcripts of trials and compare those people who were exonerated versus those who were not. And as with our lab studies, we found that truth-telling was associated with more I words and more exclusive words, and also words that suggest more detail, so use of specific references to time and location.
Well, I had always thought that about when people would tell a lot of details, I'd always thought, well, they must be telling the truth. So I was relieved to, since so many of my instincts about language were wrong in this book, I was relieved that one was right.
We have
somebody calling on line one on a cell phone. Hi, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, welcome to Focus.
Thanks. I found it particularly interesting, the comments about I versus we, because there's this ongoing, I guess it's word, animus that I have when someone like my father and occasionally my husband says, well, we'll see, or or we need to pick up the garbage or something. Oh, we do, is what I want to say. And I've told my husband, when I hear the word we, we'll see, it makes me feel like my father's sitting in judgment of me and that I don't have that anymore. And so I found it, I'm glad that you actually put words to explaining why this can really be off-putting to people.
That's right. Yeah, because basically what they're doing is trying to absolve responsibility and make it look as though there's been a committee making the decision whether or not this will happen or not.
Exactly. But anyway, I just wanted to say thank you for that.
Well, thank you.
Well, thanks so much for calling. I'm glad you're enjoying the program. Okay. So, you know, right now in American literature, many people are saying this is the age of the memoir. We now have a literature of I. We used to have the novel, an invented story or a supposedly invented story as the great American literary form. So what do you think that says about our society right now, that we want to know that the stories we read are true, that they're told in the I voice?
That's an interesting question. I wonder if it's partly just the nature of the publishing business. If we look back 100 years, the actual raw number of books published was minuscule compared to what it is right now. And the decisions of publication were made much more on... I'm trying to think, were there many memoirs at all?
Well, you had to be famous in that era, I think, to publish a memoir. You had to have been in government or a celebrity. You had to have had a life that would have been of note, of interest. Whereas now, all sorts of people publish memoirs about their experiences.
That's right. And of course, the vast majority of them never get have very many readers. I remember about 20 years ago, I was trying to sell my first book, and I ended up having a long talk with a publisher of one of the publishing houses, and we were talking about the nature of the system, because the system for a major publishing house, generally you required an agent. And this particular house also took manuscripts from others, and they said that they got maybe, you know, it's several thousand a year from people who are writing memoirs. In other words, they just got trillions of them, but they just never published them because they never sold.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they needed the whole agent system. So I wonder if the memoir business has always been large, but it just hasn't gotten through the gates before.
Yeah, maybe. It's become a trend. I mean, I think that we all are more aware that we're often being deceived.
Mm-hmm.
That was one thing you studied when you looked at deception. You looked at, and journalists also did this, researchers and journalists looked at the reasons our government leaders gave for entering the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. The project I talk about in the book is the way that the Bush administration talked about weapons of mass destruction. And this project actually was done by Jeff Hancock, who's at Cornell. It's a really clever project, and basically showing that whenever there was a discussion of it, the language turned into a much more deceptive language, a drop in the use of I and a drop in the use of these exclusive words, and becoming much more vague.
And you also looked at, I mean, another part of deception is self-deception. Maybe we think we are doing one thing, but we're doing another.
Yeah, the self-deception work, I find one of the most intriguing domains, because we all do it at different times. One of the places I started to look at this was letters of recommendation. Faculty members often have to write, you know, a large number of letters of recommendation. And, you know, some of the people you're writing for, you think they're pretty good. And then you start writing a letter, and at the end of the letter you think, God, this person's really great now that I've written the letter. But then there's others that you know.
Your accomplishments
really
have grown while you've been
really
sitting there
have.
Composing the letter.
I know, it's really, and you essentially convince yourself that the person's really great. Well, I went through and analyzed, I have several hundred letters of recommendations. And so what I did was I went and I, in retrospect, made this sheet figuring how great is this person in my own mind now. And so I did that. And then I did my computer analysis. And I was really quite surprised to see that the more I thought of them, the less I used positive emotion words. In other words, people who I thought really highly of, I didn't say, oh, they're great, they're really good. I didn't wave my hands. I said, this person did this, 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 and this. They were particularly good at such and such. In other words, I used a low rate of positive emotion words and was highly specific. Whereas if it was somebody who I was less enthusiastic about, I would say I would use a high rate of positive emotion words, but I was very low on any kind of factual information.
So we could learn to read between the lines when we receive letters of recommendation.
That's right.
In that regard. And maybe we should, I don't know, should we apply those same criteria to online dating ads? That's another thing you looked at. And I don't think most of us need a computer to know that there's some pretty, I don't know, fudging or just overly positive emphasis going on.
Exactly, a certain kind of sketchiness. No, you are right. And actually, the same Jeff Hancock I was just mentioning did a really nice project with dating, and he brought in men and women who had posted ads, dating ads, and he brought them in and he took a Xerox of their driver's license and also a picture and got height and weight, and because they had put all this information in their ads. And what he found was a really high percentage of people fudged in terms of their height and weight or age and so forth. And again, he was able to separate out the truth tellers from the liars by the way they use language in their narrative about themselves.
Interesting. Well, we have another caller on line one on a cell phone. Hi, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Hi, welcome to Focus. Do you have a question?
I may have missed some of it when I was trying to connect through the phone because of having to turn off the radio, but I don't think you covered this yet. One of the things that concerns me about this kind of research, you know, analyzing language statistically to figure out, you know, when we're being told the truth and when we're not, is that once you do the analysis, then the people who have access to the analysis and know that certain words correlate with truth-telling can then deliberately use those words to tell us lies. So that throws the correlation completely out of balance, doesn't it? How do you account for that in your research?
Actually, you're absolutely right, I think that is true. And this is going to be would be especially true for marketing people who
and politicians.
And politicians. Except here's the wonderful news. It is almost impossible to control your function words when you're talking off the cuff. You know, I've tried, and it's really difficult to do.
And that's why politicians like to speak in controlled settings only and not to have to speak off the cuff.
I think that's exactly right. And that's why I actually don't analyze speeches much. I like interviews and press conferences. They are glorious because people are caught off guard, and these function words just bubble out. But that's not to say that people might change in the way they do it, and you know, it's kind of the traditional arms race. It's not unlike dealing with your kids who fudge a story, and you catch them. Well, you won't catch them fudging it that way again. It's going to be something else.
Yeah. Well, very interesting show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, another thing you point out again in this book, I should also say, is that language is a reflection of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And you tell, I thought, really a wonderful story of what happened when you wore a recorder that a colleague had come up with for the weekend. And then when you read your own transcript, you were really surprised at what you found.
That's right. One of the projects that I've been involved with for many years is developing a system to capture natural conversation. So we have this device called the EAR, the electronically activated recorder, and it comes on for 30 seconds and goes off for about 12 minutes, and we ask people to wear this for several days. And when I was in the early stage of developing this, I wore it for a weekend, and then when I got back to school, I transcribed all of it. And I was really horrified to hear the way I was talking to my son at the time. He was about 10. And I had a daughter who was 14. And the way I talked to my wife and daughter was generally warm in the way I remembered it. But the way I talked to my son, I used very little I words. I was really emotionally detached. I was really horrified by the way that I spoke to him. And I was not even aware of it. And it really did bring about a change in the way that I was trying to connect with him. And it gave me a really good opportunity just to see language from a distance and see where I was messing up. And I should point out, I didn't afterwards make a promise to myself to start using the word I more to him or more positive emotions. Rather, my goal was to try to become more emotionally connected and going on the assumption that the language follows.
Right, and that was the point that I thought was so interesting about this, that we have to remember that the language is a reflection of the behavior, and if we want to change, we change the behavior. Which brings us to your concept of language style matching and what it can tell us about relationships.
That's right. This idea of language style matching, done with Molly Ireland and others, and the idea is if you have two people in an interaction, or two or more people, what you can do is you can calculate the degree to which the two people are using these function words at comparable rates. So if one person uses I words at, say, 6% of the time, the other person also at, say, 5.5%, and so forth, we would probably say they're matching pretty well. But what we can do is now go through and analyze any interaction and characterize it in terms of its style matching level. And we come up with actually a number, a style matching ratio.
Now, you point out that this style matching ratio shows how engaged two people are with each other. So they could be angry at each other. They could be in love with each other. But they're, if they have a, is it a one, means that they're very, very engaged.
That's right. That's right. So it's essentially how much they're on the same page. So, for example, we've done studies with speed dating where people come in and they talk to a series of people for 4 minutes each. And what we find is that we can predict who's going to go on a date with these people at rates higher than they themselves will.
That's interesting.
I just love it. We also did a study with instant messaging among young dating couples. And using that, we could predict if they were going to be dating 3 months later at rates much better than they themselves could.
Interesting. Of course, a lot of young people who have those little windows open are multitasking. Mm-hmm. And does that affect it if they're online chatting and doing three other things at the same time or not?
It might. And that might also tell us a little bit about the nature of their relationship. Because if person A is IMing with person B, and I'm actually kind of flirting with person C while I'm also talking to person B, that probably is a sign that I'm not matching very well with the person I'm presumably dating.
Well, that sounds true. Listeners, I should tell listeners that they can go to your website, and there are little exercises they can do. They can paste in text, and the program will analyze it. Is it www.secretlifeofpronouns.com? Is that right?
That's correct.
Well, I have to tell you, I decided to test your language style matching. And so I put in an online chat. I put in two different things. I tested two different things to see what scores, how well it rated my engagement with the person. The first thing I put in was an online chat with my adult son that I thought was the most intimate online chat I had ever had. Because usually we just chat about what, you know, we're going to do that weekend, or he tells me about the latest deal he's gotten on Craigslist to furnish his apartment. But this one was different because I was working outside the country, and he had to make a decision about a relationship. And during the hours he could get me, he was at work. So we had this very intimate, very long online chat about what he should do. And I entered the text for the two boxes, and the program said, 0.82, slightly below average intimacy for an online chat. Okay, so I decided to test it again. And I entered everything truthfully, my age, his age 26, and that he was family. So next I entered two emails. One, the one I got from the CEO of Netflix that I've never met and have no interest in even reading the whole thing. And then I entered an email I had written It was kind of a business email, but it was written in a warmer tone, kind of like what the CEO of Netflix was trying for, because it was written to a friend. So she wanted me to explain to her something about my work. And so I entered that. It was kind of similar, his email and my email. And that got me a 0.86.
Mm-hmm. What
so
is going
I'm
wrong?
Wondering about the limits of this computer analysis, because I think if you had showed those two examples to a real person, they would have said, wow, this is a very intimate conversation, and this is not a conversation at all.
Yes. And I would agree with you. And I think this is also a sign that I speak for all other language scientists, we're doing the best we can. What I'd be curious about is in your conversation with your son, which is really the more interesting, if it's an extremely long conversation, what happens is it's usually highest at the beginning and then it drops, because now what's happening is each of you are saying an increasing amount about your own life and your
mm-hmm,
own stories
mm-hmm.
as opposed to being on top of each other in terms of your interaction. So, for example, in speed dating, which is very different, so there you've got a 4-minute window, you are generally paying attention to the other person at that moment at a very high rate. As if that conversation was a 3-hour speed date, then it wouldn't be a speed date. A little bit later on, what happens is each person is now starting to tell their own story, and it's the quality of it changes quite a bit, and the style matching numbers would actually drop quite a bit. But at the beginning, especially in these brief ones, brief intense emotion, kind of a more emotional connection. The Ellison would be higher.
Yeah, well, I also thought when I looked at the chat that, one, of course, we have very different styles of writing. He writes like a 26-year-old. For example, in it, as I'm about to get off, I say, hey, do you remember that little pizza place we used to go to? Knowing this place will be a very powerful memory for him. And he says, nice. You know, I said, we're going there tonight. And he says, nice. Well, I don't say nice with all these eyes in it, you know. So there was that. But then I also thought, you know, not every intimate conversation is echoing, because in the conversation I'm probing. I'm saying, well, what if you did this? And what if you said this? And he's not saying that back. He's saying, well, I don't know, or I'm just not sure, or, you know, things like that. So I was thinking, well, not every intimate conversation echoes back and forth.
No, that's right. And, you know, probably a more powerful example of the style matching will be on the opposite end of the spectrum, when two people are furiously angry with one another.
Uh-huh.
Again, that's going to be a much shorter interaction. Usually that would only be a few minutes. But you can imagine being in a fight with anybody. And if you listen to fights, I started to listen to fights when I can. People essentially are saying the same thing back and forth to each other, things like, you're not listening to me. No, you're not listening to me.
Uh-huh.
But when there's this high emotion between the two, when both people are focused completely on each other as opposed to the conversation itself,
yeah,
that's where we see this LSM so high.
Well, you also looked at whether a community could have an LSM, kind of a shared style of writing, and I thought that was really interesting. And you looked at Craigslist ads to find that.
Was it
furniture, cars, and roommates?
Yeah, it was.
I assume the furniture and cars were for sale, and the roommates were not.
Exactly, that's right. But what was so fun about this project was it was more just kind of curiosity. Can you look at an entire community and see if they differ in terms of how similarly they use words? And the answer was yes, that some towns use words very similarly. So I think this is fresher in your mind than mine, but I think Portland and Salt Lake City were two towns that had very similar language among the population. And then other places like, I think, Greensboro and Fresno, California, were not very similar.
And why do you think that is? Why would some communities develop a kind of shared language?
Well, I think there's several aspects of it. One is just how similar the people in the community are. For example, one of the things we discovered was there's a thing called the Gini Index, which looks at the disparity of wealth in a community. So that it's the difference in percentage of the population that is wealthy versus poor. The greater the disparity, the less similar the people talked in the Craigslist ads. It's almost so you have two or more separate cultures talking. But as the income gets more equal in a community, the more the community uses language at similar rates. So I think part of it just reflects who the people are and the way they have shared interests in objects and goods, keeping in mind that this is Craigslist.
Right, right. It's all about buying, selling, and finding a place to live, although these are pretty basic human activities, so you could argue that this is a good indicator of...
Yeah. No, I was very surprised because it didn't hold up in terms of North or South or racial differences. It was seemed to be primarily this economic disparity.
Well, I wonder, do you think that a community who has a disparity, they don't have a shared language, I wonder if anything can be done that would change that? Would any kind of language activities, you know, some communities have, they all read the same book or something and talk about it. I wonder if that would make any difference.
I would doubt it.
I
think you need to have something a little more grand.
It's like getting at something a little deeper.
Yeah, like a natural disaster or a, you know, something that pulls them all together.
Okay.
That's another thing that we do know is when there is a shared problem, communities do start talking similarly.
That is a really interesting subject, and I urge our listeners to go and read this book. It's very fascinating and a lot of fun, but unfortunately, we're going to have to bring our conversation here to an end. Thank you so much, James Pennebaker. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
You bet. I've enjoyed it. The less similar the people talked in the Craigslist ads. It's almost so you have two or more separate cultures talking. But as the income gets more equal in a community, the more the community uses language at similar rates. So I think part of it just reflects who the people are and the way they have shared interests in objects and goods, keeping in mind that this is Craigslist.
Right, right. It's all about buying, selling, and finding a place to live, although these are pretty basic human activities, so you could argue that this is a good indicator of...
Yeah. No, I was very surprised because it didn't hold up in terms of North or South or racial differences. It was seemed to be primarily this economic disparity.
Well, I wonder, do you think that a community who has a disparity, they don't have a shared language, I wonder if anything can be done that would change that? Would any kind of language activities, you know, some communities have, they all read the same book or something and talk about it. I wonder if that would make any difference.
I would doubt it.
I
think you need to have something a little more grand.
It's like getting at something a little deeper.
Yeah, like a natural disaster or a, you know, something that pulls them all together.
Okay.
That's another thing that we do know is when there is a shared problem, communities do start talking similarly.
That is a really interesting subject, and I urge our listeners to go and read this book. It's very fascinating and a lot of fun, but unfortunately, we're going to have to bring our conversation here to an end. Thank you so much, James Pennebaker. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
You bet. I've enjoyed it.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
more than a month today, extending overnight losses on renewed concerns about the Greek debt and pressure from a surging dollar. A lack of progress from finance ministers in solving Europe's debt crisis at weekend meetings and avoiding a default by Greece actually sent to the world stocks and commodities tumbling. Investors' flight from risk assets such as commodities and into safe havens has pushed the U.S. dollar higher today, and that, of course, adding pressure on dollar-denominated commodities as well. Let's go ahead.